Welcome to BIO, a podcast produced by the Biographers International Organization. BIO is devoted to promoting the work of biographers and advocating for biography as a genre, with the support of biographers and biography lovers worldwide. I'm BIO member Sonia Williams in Washington, D.C. On each episode, we'll talk with a biographer about his or her work. This time, literary critic and first-time biographer Adam Plunkett talks about his book, Love and Need, The Life of Robert Frost's Poetry. This examination of Robert Frost, one of 20th century America's favorite poets, was published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux in February 2025. Adam Plunkett was interviewed by fellow biographer and BIO member Heather Clark.
Hello. Are here today to discuss Love and Need, Adam Plunkett's erudite and beautifully written critical biography of Robert Frost, which has gotten some rave reviews. And I'm just really excited to speak with you about this today, Adam. We were both Leon Levy fellows together, right? In 2016, 2017. We were both working on books about iconic American poets, and we both had this feeling that Robert Frost and Sylvia Plath had kind of calcified and were sort of buried under these myths about who they were. Their poetic legacies had been a bit simplified. We kind of felt they were misunderstood. We wanted to reframe them, I think, in a way that would allow for a more serious and thoughtful engagement with their poetry and their poetic legacy. So can you tell us a little bit about what led you to spend several years of your life writing this biography of Robert Frost? Why Frost?
Well, first of all, thank you for that beautiful introduction. It's great to be here. I think you put it really, really well about the sense that these things are ossifying. And yeah. I was working in journalism. I was writing mostly about poetry. And this brash young person's journalist way, I kind of thought I knew what there was to know about Frost. Then the first volume of Frost letters from this excellent Harvard University Press edition came out, and I started reading them. And it was stranger the more I read.
How so?
Well, the way his mind worked, it didn't quite make sense to me. At first, I kind of thought this is kind of fits into these patterns that I thought I understood. And then the closer I got to it, I was like, no, there's more here. And I don't really see it. I don't really get what's going on. And then I was thinking about one of the poems of Frost that I had known really well ever since I was 15 years old. And just one day sitting in my cubicle, I was thinking about it. And I was like, oh, gosh, there's so much more to this than I had realized. And one thing led to another. And the long and short of it is that my own sense of Frost had calcified in exactly the way that you're describing, both as a person and as a poet. And I realized that the only way I thought that I could get into the poetry was to really interrogate and shift this image of the person that people thought they understood.
Now, that's very interesting to me that you decided in your quest for this deeper understanding of Frost, you decided to go in the more biographical direction, because you could have decided, I'm going to write a literary critical study, but you didn't. You wrote a biography. And was it very clear to you from the start that you wanted to write a biography?
I think that for Frost, as for Plath, I'd say, so much of people's intuitive judgments of what might be going on in the poem, not necessarily what is, but just what might be going on, had to do with their sense of what his psychology was like, what he was like as a person. And I realized that people would not believe me when I said, there's all this other stuff going on, you got to trust me, unless they saw that he was different from what they thought he was, and also that I wouldn't understand it. There was so much to Frost's lived experience and also his inner life and the kind of stream of sources that people would not understand if I didn't tell the story.
I love that, because those of us who studied English literature back in the day, I certainly was trained not to connect the work and the life when I was interpreting a poem. I mean, it was still very much a new critical kind of way of reading poetry, and biography was a dirty word in the academy and maybe still is, in especially, the study of English literature. And I really like this idea of kind of shifting that and approaching these writers through their life. I mean, the subtitle of your book is The Life of Robert Frost Poetry. And you braid the literary criticism and the life so well in your book. And I feel like I'm in the hands of someone who deeply, deeply understands Robert Frost's poetry. I trust you. There are a lot of very sophisticated and brilliant close readings in your book. They open up Frost, they open up the poems, but I can see that you took a risk by doing that. So, can you talk a little bit about how do you balance the life and the work? What was that decision process like for you?
I think that the two parts of your question about the received academic standards and the status of biography and the relation between life and work in my book both have to do with the sense of authority that one speaks with, and also that I knew I would speak with as a critic. I didn't go to grad school, but it was important to me that people not take my word for these things. I also didn't think they would. And so I thought that I had to really make the case. And I think that there's a trade-off there. It kind of slows things down. On the other hand, I think there's something very democratic about it because I'm not asking you to understand things ahead of time. I'm trying to walk you through them. And I think that one of the central things about Frost is that his originality comes from this very, very deep and thorough borrowing from earlier work that has not really been explored because Frost made it hard to see. There are all these points where I show things people hadn't pointed out before, people hadn't discovered before. For example, the relationship between The Road Not Taken and this poem of Emerson's, Étienne de Lavoisier. That's the sort of thing where if you, in a kind of Harold Bloomian aside, say like, and he's doing this, you're like, okay, well, if you say so, I don't know. So it felt essential to me to try to do that. And I would say also that the whole book for me is really about what Frost would call getting close to the poems. I think close reading, when it's done well, allows you to really, really get close to something and really experience it. And so that's what I hope to do in the book.
Yeah, I think you achieved that beautifully. I mean, it's to me, this is a much more literary biography of a writer than ones we tend to see because you get so deep into the poetry. And like you said, it's one thing to say, well, Frost was influenced by Tennyson. It's quite another to show in this sort of granular, confident, authoritative way. Well, this is exactly how he's influenced by Tennyson. This is how he's influenced by In Memoriam. And let me show you all of these new connections. But were there other moments of discovery and kind or aha moments like no one's ever seen this letter or no one's ever made this connection and any other moments like that for you?
One of the major ones, years into the project, I realized that so much of his early poetry is this very, very complex and subtle borrowing from reframing of In Memoriam, Tennyson's extremely powerful and very popular in Victorian literature elegy sequence. That's another poem I digress a little bit, but is more powerful the more you read it, I think, and the less you kind of read the received understandings of it. I mean, but I digress.
I get it. I get the urge to
No, I know, I know. It's just
I totally get it.
but I think where that comes from is just that discovering those things allows me, and I think allows me to show the reader just seeing what Frost saw, because you can't really get in the mind of the writer, but you can see what they're seeing. And seeing what they're seeing in their inner life, which in the life of literature, which is the most important thing to poets, it's just unbelievably thrilling to me. I mean, it's almost ecstatic. There's that. There's the whole section about Edward Thomas. I had realized that he, in writing about Thomas, is borrowing partly from Catullus's ode to his brother. Frost called Thomas the only brother I ever had. He's also borrowing from the immortality ode, Wordsworth's great ode on the loss of innocence and youth, which is, Thomas at that point, it would call it simply the ode. I mean, it's one of the great elegiac poems in our literature. And just realizing the stuff and realizing that Frost as he found genuinely original ways to put his experience into words, also drawing from, the poems that meant most to him, was absolutely thrilling. Realizing that Birches is a revision of Lycidas, one of the great poems in language, I mean, that was unbelievable to me.
Yeah, that was so thrilling because I when I read it, it just felt like you were making so many connections. It was like fireworks going off, right? And it was such a fresh approach too to Frost. It was sort of the best mix of like new critical close reading, but also embellishing that with insights about the life and kind of braiding all of that together in this kind of biographical critical way that I think is can be really useful as an approach to writing and writers. And I think we need to stop calling biography a dirty word and stop sort of acting like it's this sensationalistic way to look at a writer's oeuvre. All right, just a little aside. Last night, Mary Beard gave the Leon Levy
Oh, right. Yeah, I was
lecture.
talking to
Yeah,
you.
she did. And she started off by talking about Sylvia Plath and Janet Malcolm and Janet Malcolm's famous phrase from The Silent Woman about biographers being burglars, rifling through drawers, right? And I get really tired of that remark. And I get tired of people quoting that remark because I think it's a facile way to understand biography and biographers, and it's disrespectful to what we do. You and I spent years, almost a decade, right, writing these literary biographies. Our footnotes are like 200 pages long. We take this approach seriously, and we do the best we can. The life can illuminate the work.
I strongly agree with you. And I think that the best way I frame it to myself is that people are making a categorical judgment based on a stereotype of the worst aspects of the genre. The thing about biography is that to do it well, to make these judgments well, it's a matter of taste and judgment and discernment. And you feel that as a reader. Any other walk of life, judging an entire category of activity based on the bad stereotypes of the practitioners who do it poorly, I think would be seen as facile, and it's very silly. But I'm very heartened by how the genre seems to be received in and outside academia now, even relative to, when I was in college, which is, 20 odd years or so ago.
Yeah, absolutely. I think things are getting better, partly because of Biographers International and the Leon Levy Center, which just gets, I think, more and more support every year. And so, speaking of biographies and biographers, you open your book with this scene in which Frost is meeting his biographer, Lawrence Thompson, for the first time. So, can you talk a little bit about Thompson's Frost biography and why you decided to open your biography with this sort of moment from a different biography?
Larry Thompson meets Frost in the mid-1920s. He's a college student and he becomes completely entranced, falls under Frost's spell, and then gets appointed as Frost's biographer at a very fraught time in Frost's life when Larry is a young man, I believe in his early 30s. And Larry, with this kind of brash, young, rising academics sense, he's like, ah, well, Frost is this old man, I'll do this for a few years and that'll be the end of it. And of course, Larry dies as he's trying to complete the second of three volumes. And the whole story of the relationship between them is itself the sort of thing where, in excellent books about contemporary biography, this is a story that features very prominently. And the way that story is told is of Larry gradually coming to resent Frost and then trying to attack Frost in the book. That story of the relationship has itself ossified. In my book, I'm both trying to unseat the image that is created of Frost by that biography and also unseat the image of that relationship and trying to show what actually happened and why it matters and how you can understand Frost by understanding the contours of that. And it's something where the actual details of the facts of the situation and the drama surrounding it, I think, are quite different than the received understanding of them.
Yeah, I love that you're taking on these two different tasks in a way, opening up the poetry, teaching us about the poetry, but also looking at Frost's legacy through the eyes of this other biography. And Helen Venler, what was her exact phrase that Thompson had sort of turned Frost into a monster? Was that it?
The word monster is involved, and she wonders how, from the story told in volume two, anyone could avoid the impression that Frost is a monster. And what's funny is that the received version of this is, you know, Larry creates the monster myth, but Helen's point is like, well, Thompson doesn't really seem to get that Frost is a monster. He seems kind of anodyne about it. She doesn't really see the extent to which this is a creation of Thompson's, although based on later work, she comes to revise that in the 80s, but the damage has been done.
But I feel like your book undoes the damage. Your Frost is not a monster. I mean, I don't think he is this horrible, kind of nasty, selfish person that some of the previous biographies, especially his, I guess, have put forth.
Absolutely. I think that Frost is a very complex person. The way that Frost's very close and old friend with an extremely fraught relationship put it about him was that he was a large man who also contained a smaller man, and the two are kind of at war with each other. I think his inner life was extremely restless and complicated, even to himself. And I think that a lot of the things that we come to hear in the poetry is this, you know, what for Plath is that the ultimate voice of sanity was for Frost an extraordinary psychic and also extraordinary literary achievement that you can feel. And what I hope to show in the book is the sense of someone who, by means of poetry and by means of this kind of life of the mind that also involves teaching with people, is able to really produce wonderful insight and wonderful appreciation for life out of a foundation that is extremely difficult, extremely fraught psychologically, and ultimately is not, by and large, a prisoner to his own circumstances in psychology by what he's able to find and then create for himself and the people around him. And I should say, too, that part of what I try to do in the book is not defend him. You know, I think he does a bunch of stuff that I don't think is good, to put it mildly. But I think the point is that if we're having a conversation about artists where the work is great, then if we're talking about whether or not they're good morally, it's not that it's beside the point, but it's not the whole point. The important thing has to be, okay, what does this tell us about the kind of value that has been created by the work, and how does the life inform that? And I think that perhaps the reveal will be how I make the case, not what the case is. But one major thesis of the book is that people say that the problem with the Thompson story is that it made Frost seem bad. And I don't think that's true. I think we're actually quite comfortable with artists that we love having abhorrent views in various respects, or doing abhorrent things in various respects. The hard thing is artists who are boring. Thompson makes Frost look boring because he makes him look explicable. And I'm trying to say that this is somebody that we want to wonder at, not always trust, not always accept, but wonder at, because he still has so much to give us.
Yeah, I felt like he was a more generous and capacious person in your book than I had given him credit for. And I thought you did a great job when it came to the minefield of women.
Navigating his relationships with women, I think the relationships were extraordinarily fraught and complex. And I really tried throughout to not take sides. You know, I think that his relationships with women are exceptionally revealing of his psychology and his principles. They certainly don't always paint him in a great light, but you really can't understand Frost at all without understanding these really fraught dynamics. And the relationship with Kay, it's very fascinating. And Kay is a younger woman who comes to be very close with Frost after Frost's wife dies pretty tragically when Frost, I think it's 64, still has a tremendous amount of vitality left. And one pretty fascinating and I think extremely important story for understanding the received image of Frost is that Frost has this something like a nervous breakdown, basically tries to hide the received version of him that had been very laudatory before his wife dies, feels this sense of guilt and grief that he expresses in the sense of this conviction of his own badness and his own awfulness. And then appoints Larry, the new biographer, right when he's in the thick of this extremely psychologically convulsive episode. And so the relationship with Kay and the testimony that comes out of that winds up being extremely important because it's a window into who Frost was and how the story is made that we would come to understand Frost through. And I think that there's a lot of subtlety in how the book treats the facts of what happened between them. Without giving the game away too much, I would just say that the reviews have been wonderful, but I think that some reviews have said, Frost and Kay slept together. Other reviews have said, Adam says they don't sleep together. And I would just tell anyone listening to maybe bracket all of that and read for yourself to see what you think happened.
I would agree with that because I think the way you handled that material was just superb. It's a tough story to navigate, and it seems like there's differing evidence, people saying contradictory things, and as a biographer, that's always one of the most difficult paths to go down. Like, who was right? What is the real story? I mean, I certainly had that happen to me. Like, different testimonies about the party where Plath met Hughes, and people saying, "No, I was there and it was this way." "No, I was there and it was this way." And
Well, it
so
was quite a party, so I,
it was quite a party. So anyway, I just wanted to congratulate you on that and just in navigating that kind of difficult biographical and emotional terrain. I thought you did a really good job. In terms of your research process, you make all of these fascinating new connections in terms of Frost influences, literary influences. Did you figure that out all on your own with your, because you're just, an amazingly well-read person? Or were there letters where Frost gives you a little clue about, oh, well, I was reading Lycidas the other day, and then, you find a draft of Birches. Like, how did that process happen?
Well, it was a lot of work. But one thing I did early on in the process, I had an intuition that this was going to be a big part of the book, in part because I had the sense that from the education I got, it was relatively standard, I mean, excellent, but relatively standard, education in English literature, right? Pretty similar to one you got, I'm sure, where kind of similar standards and similar sense of what the canon was. And I realized that if I didn't really have the tools, it meant we didn't really know how to read Frost's set of influences. Also, we didn't really have that kind of intuitive critical tool set for understanding the kinds of poems Frost was writing. And that meant that we didn't totally understand what Frost was drawing from. So I knew that I need to kind of build my own sense of what Frost's canon was. And so it started out by making a separate file and separate notes of the different references Frost makes. You can triangulate that, or I did triangulate that with Frost's library and the parts of his library that he's drawing on, the editions he knows when, with references and letters and stuff like that. And, where there are markings, where there are notes, I mean, those are the best, what kind of books he's teaching, when. And, I spent the better part of a year just reading carefully the different things that I thought might have been important to Frost with an eye for this. I mean, I certainly would not have picked these things up just kind of, out of nowhere. And the Emerson poem is a great example of this, where, I think Emerson's poetry is fascinating, but it was, quite familiar in the 19th century up until the last few decades of it or so, I suppose, but it's kind of fallen off. People don't read this stuff anymore. It's kind of hard. We don't really have the same vocabulary for it in the same way anymore. So yeah, it was a lot of work, put it that way, and a lot of digging.
A lot of digging, and you can really see that in the book in just the depth of knowledge on really every page. I mean, it's astounding. And again, this goes back to the kind of flippant, like, oh, biographers, they're just rifling around in people's drawers. And no, there's a lot more that goes on, right?
In the good ones.
Yes, in the good, right? And so I think maybe a lot of listeners would be interested in how you decided upon the structure that you used in the book. I mean, it's mostly chronological, your book, but it does go back and forth in time. So could you just talk a little bit about how you chose that particular structure?
Absolutely. I knew that the book would be relatively slow going in its treatment of any individual poem. In part because what I'm trying to extract from any given poem is also something that serves as an example and a kind of representative case of multiple things. I'm also trying to tell the cohesive story of how Frost became Frost, really, and how Frost art developed through what he's seeing in these poems. That meant that the parts where I talked about poetry couldn't just be a survey of, okay, then this book came out and here's what these works are kind of like, because in that case, it's particularized, but it's not really representative. Everything had to be representative. It had to be deep. But it meant that the kind of real estate that would be taken up by the readings of the poetry would be proportionally much higher than you can do if you're doing a kind of more standard structure. And what that meant was that the book had to be kind of compressed in the biographical parts, because those had to be very selectively chosen. And one of the big decisions I made was not trying to do a really big, comprehensive book that just would supplant Thompson as, you know, the authoritative, you know, full thing. I thought that would overwhelm people, and was really, you know, was really two books. And I came to this sort of balanced structure in part because it needed the story to situate the life of the poetry and show why these things matter and allow people to feel why they matter as they go. But I had this intuitive sense that if I tried to do that while also tackling everything else going on, then the stuff that I thought was most important for understanding Frost would be lost in the thick of things.
Yeah, I thought the structure worked really well, and it was innovative as well. And did it take you a long time to find that perfect structure? Like, did you start out that way?
Oh, God, no. You know, there was so much I thought that was so necessary to say. I turned in the first draft that's more than twice the length that it came to. And my editor, you know, is a lovely person, very encouraging, was like, well, Adam, you need to cut this in half and give it a structure. And so, you know, necessity, the mother of invention.
Okay, got it. Yeah, editors can be very helpful that way.
Oh, yeah.
So thank you, Adam, for writing this amazing book. Read it if you haven't. And congratulations.
Thank you so much. Really, it's been incredible.
All right, you're very welcome.
That was first-time biographer Adam Plunkett speaking with fellow biographer Heather Clark about his book, Love and Need, The Life of Robert Frost's Poetry. It was published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux in February 2025. And this interview was recorded via Zoom on March 12th of this year. To learn more about Bio or to hear other episodes in our podcast series, please visit our website, biographersinternational.org. I'm Bio member Sonia Williams in Washington, D.C. Darren Neblett created our theme music. And until next time, thanks so much for listening and have a wonderful day.